less successive life, but stayed young and vigorous while the hidden portrait aged hideously. The story could well serve as an allegory for the United States and its profligate role in driving the planet into the worsening climate catastrophe. The U.S. remains the world's historically greatest emitter of greenhouse gases. It's the wealthiest country in history, too, but achieved that with over 150 years of unrelenting industrial pollution, treating the world's atmosphere as an open sewer for the toxic exhaust from its smokestacks and tailpipes. Now, President Trump denies that there's a problem, pointing to rising polluting economies like China and India. While China, with its 1.4 billion people, is currently the greatest emitter of greenhouse gases, the U.S. is still a close second, with all other nations far behind. Plus, our per capita emissions are still among the highest, signifying, on average, a carbon-intensive, unsustainable lifestyle. Meanwhile, on the front lines of the climate disaster, entire communities are damaged or destroyed. Bangladesh is experiencing the worst flooding in a century. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies reports that 7.6 million people there are at risk of hunger and disease. A deadly heat wave swept across Europe this summer, breaking temperature records and sparking wildfires. Ice sheets in Antarctica are melting much faster than previously known, leading to one estimate that sea level rises as a result could displace 2 billion people by the year 2100. In the midst of Hurricane Dorian, Dennis McLean, a spokesperson for the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction, spoke to reporters.
This is the fourth consecutive year that we have witnessed an extremely devastating Atlantic hurricane season, including Category 5 hurricanes like Dorian. The sequence cannot be divorced from the fact that these last 5 years have been the hottest ever recorded because of the continuing rise in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Hurricane Dorian crystallizes the existential threat posed to small island developing states by the ongoing climate emergency.
The population of the Bahamas currently is about 90% Afro-Bahamian. The country's history is interwoven with colonialism and liberation. Christopher Columbus's first landfall in 1492 was in the Bahamas, where he launched a genocide against the indigenous inhabitants. After Britain eliminated the slave trade in 1807, many who escaped slavery in the U.S., as well as Seminoles fleeing the U.S. Army in Florida, found refuge in the Bahamas.
The Bahamas, like the rest of the Caribbean, is extremely vulnerable, also due to the ongoing legacy of colonialism, the legacy of slavery and indenture that sort of manifested in systemic global exploitation and local corruption as well.
That's Dr. Christian Campbell, a Bahamian poet, scholar, and essayist who was born in Grand Bahama, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Rescue efforts in the Bahamas are severely hampered by the level of destruction. Inlets are impassable, docks are damaged, and the airports are either underwater or simply destroyed. The U.S. Coast Guard is providing some aid, but the United States, as the greatest emitter of greenhouse gases in history, has a much larger role to play. Dorian Gray, in Oscar Wilde's novel, was ultimately consumed by his excesses, dead on the floor beneath his portrait. The Bahamian survivors of Hurricane Dorian will overcome and forge a path forward. But time is short for the United States to change its ways and assume its proper place in the global effort to avoid irreversible climate catastrophe. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Listen to music and voices. Listen to work and play. Listen to eat and drink. Listen to noise and fun. Listen to pink and blue. Listen to a heart rainbow. Listen to wizards and witches. Listen to jazz play. Listen to dogs and mice. Listen to Rome and Italy. Listen to Mars and Venus. Listen to the planet. Listen to teeth and trunks. Listen to Kaizen and Violet. Listen to Stars and Stripes. Listen to Texas. Listen to bells and waterfalls. Listen to churches and steeple. Dance and sing and listen and bells. Listen to making things, stripes and zigzags. Bike riding and zigzagging. No, listen to bike riding and curving. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio WGXC.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tim Kennelty, Master Gardener Volunteer with Cornell Cooperative Extension, and I'm joined by Jean Thomas and Teresa Golden, two of our Master Gardener Volunteers.
We're talking to Rebecca Pommetier, Cornell Cooperative Extension's Coordinator for Nutrition, Parenting, and Special Projects. Becky is a certified master food preparer and will guide us through the proper channels to make the most of all our hard work.
So today we have Rebecca Pommetier, who's the coordinator of Nutrition, Parenting, and Special Projects for Columbia Greene Cornell Cooperative Extension. She's also certified as a master food preserver. And while we just talked about harvesting the garden, now we want to talk about preserving the garden harvest. And so, Becky, that's a ton of responsibility that you've got. Today we'll be talking about how to preserve food in different ways. And so why don't we start by what are the types of food preservation that you normally teach?
Well, I do really four main types. We have freezing, which sometimes involves vacuum sealing, dehydrating, canning, and fermentation.
Becky, what are the biggest dangers? We hear about people eating preserved food and getting sick. What are the main causes?
Well, of course, foodborne illness, especially botulism, is always what people think about when they think about food preservation. So what we always say is if you are following a evidence-based, tested recipe and instructions, you should have no worries because they have already figured out kind of the optimum temperatures, length and time to make sure whatever food is being preserved is safe and ready for long-term storage.
So how do you decide which method is best?
It's really dependent on what somebody is most interested in and kind of what they have they would like to preserve. And also even it comes down to things like storage space. So it's really personal what people like. I know that a lot of people enjoy canning because then something's shelf stable so they can easily store it like in a pantry or a closet. Others like freezing because it's a quicker method. But at the same time, you have to actually have the freezer space. And then still others like dehydrating because that's probably the type of food preservation that takes up the least amount of space.
So if you had something like tomatoes, is there a best way to preserve tomatoes?
Not really. Tomatoes are one of those produce items that can be preserved and all the different methods. And again, it's going to be really dependent on what you're interested in, what kind of your space limitations are, your time limitations, and also how you plan on using it. So for example, a tomato that's dehydrated. Some people like to just eat those, but in general, that'd probably be something that'd be really good for like a soup or something where you're going to stick it in a liquid and get it rehydrated. Again, canning is another one that, depending how you want to use it afterwards, that might be the method you really want. So it's really going to be dependent on many factors. So, and it's also interest. I know a lot of people now are getting back into like canning because it's kind of like the oldest method and their grandparents did it. So it's going to come down to a lot of different factors.
Okay, this is Teresa and Jean with the Cornell Cooperative Extension Master Gardeners Digging In program. For those of you who are just tuning in more recently, we're talking to Rebecca Pommetier about preserving food. Becky, where do we get the food to preserve?
Really, you can get it from anywhere as long as it's fresh and recently picked. So we like to say, like, from vine to pot and with and hopefully 24 hours. Realistically, the shortest amount of time you can do that, the better. So if it has to be a little longer past 24 hours, that's fine. But just know that the product you put into the can, the freezer, the dehydrator is the product you're going to get out. So if you're using something that's like not the best, a second, something that you were like, I don't really want to eat this, so I'll preserve it instead. What you're going to get out is a product that's not quite as as good. So you can get it out of your own garden's probably best, because then you know how long it's been sitting around. Farmers markets, produce stands, pick your own places. All of those places are options. I know a lot of the local farm stands around here will let you buy things in bulk. So you can go in and say, I want to can 40 quarts of tomatoes. Can I buy that amount of tomatoes from you? And obviously they will sell them that way. So it's, again, what your preferences are and what is available to you in your area.
Is that's because of a food safety issue or just a vitamin? So it's healthier?
Well, it's more about food quality. So, again, it comes down to, like, if you want beautiful, you know, county blue ribbon food that or jam, you got to put in the ripest, best looking strawberries. So it's more about quality. When we talk about those types of topics in terms of food safety, one of the ones that really surprises people that we tell them to stay away from is drops. So a lot of people like to take like apples that have dropped off the tree and use that for like apple butter or something along those lines. And we tell people you shouldn't use drops at all, because you just do not know in that process of dropping to the ground what could have gotten into them. So that's one of the ones that kind of surprises people. When we talk about food safety, you really have no way of knowing what's on your produce. So you can go somewhere and it could be the nicest looking produce you've ever seen, but it could still harbor something like botulism or E. coli. So that's why really the method and how you're going about it is the most important. And I think if we talk about food safety, the one that people are most scared about is botulism and canning. And so there's really only two recommended types of canning, which is boil water canning, which is you think about the big like stock pot looking thing that you bring water up to boil and then you put the jars in. And then there's pressure canning. And pressure canning is with a special equipment, a pressure canner, that you bring it under a certain level of pressure for probably a longer period of time. The trick there is knowing that certain produce cannot be boil water canned from a food safety perspective. So it has to go with the acidity in the food. So fruit, for example, is pretty much always safe to put in a boil water canner because fruit is very high in acid. Produce, if you're just going to take your summer squash, for example, and can it, has to be done in a pressure canner because that's where the botulism risk is, actually. What makes people sick from botulism, and I'm kind of going off on that tangent because that's what people think about the most when we talk about canning, is that botulism, the boiled water canning canner, is actually the perfect environment for people to get sick with botulism. So it's not botulism itself that makes people sick. It's the spores that are produced when botulism is threatened and kind of goes into this emergency shell they build that releases toxins. And what happens with a boil water canner is it gets right to the optimum temperature that they produce those spores. And also, you're creating a vacuum seal, so an airless, airtight environment, and botulism thrives in an airtight environment. So the pressure canner actually just takes the temperature of the water up even further than what you can get with boiling water alone to a place that's safe, and we know it will kill off the botulism completely and it won't produce those spores. So if we're dealing with, like, I have a vegetable garden and I don't want to worry about pressure canning, what can I do with it? Your real only option is to add acid, also known as pickling. So that's where pickling comes in. Pickling can always be done in a boil water canner because you're adding acid to the food. And the thing about pickling, I tell people, is that is one of the things that you really do want to make sure you're using a trusted, tested recipe for, and you cannot fool with it because the ratios of salt and vinegar in a canned product is what's making it safe.
Okay, well that's pretty thorough about canning. What are the pitfalls and advantages to the other formats?
So the other formats, what we're really talking about, so the only format that botulism becomes an issue with is actually freezing something that's vacuum sealed. Because with vacuum sealing, you're removing the air, which I just said botulism really loves. And it's safe in the freezer. But when you start bringing it up to temperature by defrosting it, again, you're creating that environment for botulism to produce those spores. So the trick there is that you have to introduce air to the food before you defrost it. In other words, take the package out, slice it so the air gets back in, and then bring it up to temperature in your refrigerator, defrosting it safely. And then it will be safe and you won't have to worry about that.
So if you get into dehydrating, that's a whole nother process, but does that eliminate the risk because of the
dehydrating, freezing, because botulism, it's the spores that you're not producing those, because the methods you're using aren't going to produce an environment where you have heat and no air. So those are safe from the botulism perspective. In general, dehydrating is very safe. When we talk about dehydrating, we're really more worried about fungus growth on the dehydrated food after the fact. What you can do to prevent like mold and that type of growth is actually, believe it or not, freeze things that you've already dehydrated. So you dehydrate and then you freeze.
Oh, wow.
Or you got a fruit, it's really an issue with, because there's a lot of moisture in fruit, so you oftentimes can't get all the liquid out. So we do a process called conditioning, which is you put the fruit in like an airtight container after it's been dehydrated, and you leave it in there for like a week, and you have to like keep going in and shaking it. And if there's a lot of moisture, condensation building up, you know that you did not get all the liquid out of it, so you probably should put it back in to dehydrate further.
So now you've got me terrified about fermentation.
One thing into another. It's nothing really to be terrified of. Like I always joke, honestly, botulism is really the only one that you hear of those stories from the 1900s where whole families were wiped out. So when we're talking about the other ones, it's more like the foods that you would worry about making you sick in general. So you're taking produce in off of the field. What are the risks there? E. coli, salmonella, all the other scary things. You would just do the same level of what you would do to those vegetables, make them safe to eat right off the vine. You would do the same thing to make them safe to freeze or dehydrate. In terms of fermentation, again, we're really talking about spoilage. And with fermentation, it's more that the product ends up being soggy and kind of gross. So with fermentation, we're talking about making sauerkraut and pickles mostly. And that really has more to do with air temperature. So while you're fermenting, you have to keep the temperature under 78 degrees. And if it gets above 78, that's when the product's going to go bad. So a lot of people try to ferment pickles in the middle of the summer, for example. And then if they don't have central air, their house gets up to like 90 degrees, the product's going to go bad.
And we can find more information on food safety and storage on the Columbia Green website at ccecolumbiagreen.org.
Yes.
What are the pitfalls of freezing?
Freezing doesn't have a lot of pitfalls. I actually say it's one of my favorite ones because it's usually quick, easy, and it doesn't have a lot of the same issues. It's the same things I just said. Whatever you would do from a food safety perspective to eat the food, you do it to freeze it. It has more to do with quality. So some certain foods just don't freeze well, or how you want to use them, it doesn't come out well. So for example, if you're freezing a bunch of berries, when you freeze berries, they produce a liquid. So if you're putting them in a pie or something, that's a great method. If you want to just take them out to eat, that's probably not the way you want to go about trying to preserve them.
So what are the most common questions you get asked about food preservation?
Well, I covered pretty much all the ones I get about canning. I get a lot of questions about certain, which items are safe and okay to freeze. And I can't go into the, it's an exhaustive list of what is okay and what's not. I would say if anybody has questions, they can give me a call and I would answer that. Like if you have a specific, I have this item, I want to freeze it, is it safe? Give me a call and I do that case by case is a big one.
You mentioned something earlier about tomatoes, that there's today's tomatoes are different than our grandmother's tomatoes?
Yes, absolutely. So tomatoes are a funny thing. A lot of people think about them as a vegetable, but they're a fruit. So they are high in acid, but they're on the low end of the acid scale when we talk about fruit. So what happens with tomatoes is that if you are preserving them, you have to add a little acid to them to make sure they're safe. And that's not a, it sounds scary when I say add acid, but really that's lemon juice. It's throwing a couple teaspoons of lemon juice in the bottom of whatever container you're using, and then they're going to be safe. And what has happened, because I know I get this a lot, people go, well, my grandmother canned tomatoes her whole life. Everything was safe. We've actually bred tomatoes to be less acidic because that's what we like to, the taste of. So today's tomatoes are not the same as the tomatoes your grandmother ate. And actually, there's absolutely no way for anybody to say this tomato has this much acid in it. It was just not known. They're all grown at different acidity levels now. So tomatoes is kind of a funny thing.
You mentioned something about jellies, too.
Yes. So I get a lot of calls about something failing. So I get people on jam and jelly season call and say, my jam and jelly broke, it's not gelled, what can I do? Well, first of all, after the fact, I makes a really good ice cream sauce, so don't throw it away, you got options. But beforehand, you want to consider what fruit you're using. So when something doesn't gel, it's probably because it doesn't have enough sugar or pectin in it to do it. So certain fruits just will never have enough pectin, some sometimes have enough. I actually tell people to be safe just to use a commercial pectin, and that way you can pretty much be assured it's going to gel on you. Also, don't mess with the sugar in a recipe either. So people want to be like, I want to make a low sugar jam, which is great, but unless you buy specific pectin that says no sugar, low sugar, it's not going to work. And I also get a lot of questions about jars not sealing and canning. So my jar didn't seal, what do I do? And I always tell people if it's only been like 24 hours, they can either put it in the refrigerator and eat that food right away, or it can actually be reprocessed. So they can put a new top on and put it back in the canner, and then it might seal.
You also mentioned that it's really important to get recipes off a quality from a quality source.
Yes.
What would you recommend?
Well, if you want to do something online, you absolutely can go to our website, Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can also Google the National Center for Home Food Preservation is another great resource. And we have links to some other resources on our website. In terms of books, because some people like to just have them right in front, you can be safe with the Ball Blue Book that comes out pretty much annually. And also, So Easy to Preserve, the 6th edition, is also considered a safe resource to get your recipes from. We will really tell people nowadays to stay away from kind of their grandmother's recipes and their methods, because there's been a lot of evidence and research on what really is the safest and also most delicious ways of doing things. I do get a lot of questions where people will actually say, well, my grandmother did it for years, no one really got sick, what do I have to worry about? And it's the same with any kind of food if you're just cooking it. Not every cucumber that comes out of the garden has something on it that will make you sick. Most of them won't, but you have no way of knowing. So you can actually improperly do this stuff your whole life and never get sick because you were just lucky. But then if you're one of the unlucky few that pulls in, or there's E. coli or salmonella outbreak in a field and you use that particular item, now somebody's going to get sick.
How do our listeners learn about and learn more about how to do this safely. Does Cornell offer classes?
Yes, we do. I offer classes. I try to offer them monthly in the food preservation season, which is kind of June through September, October, when produce is coming into season. We do have an upcoming class on pickling on September 27th at 6 o'clock at night at the Hudson office. That's a Friday. And then we might have more upcoming, depending on how that one turns out.
So our listeners can look at, go to ccecolumbiagreen.org and look at upcoming events to find out what else is happening. In addition, they can go to the parenting and nutrition portion of the website, and they'll get additional information about preservation as well as about the food safety and storage.
Yes, and they can also call me. So I am available for like phone consultations if you're in the moment and you need a question answered.
Do you want to give out your phone number?
It is 518-622-9820, extension 117.
Excellent. You've got a lot of other responsibilities besides food preservation. So why don't you talk about some of the other things that you do at Cornell?
I actually am the coordinator for the Parenting, Nutrition, and Special Projects Program. And some of our bigger upcoming programs include Parenting with Confidence, which is available in both Columbia and Greene counties. And that's an in-home parenting education program that families can take advantage of. I also offer anger management classes Thursday evenings over in Hudson at 6 o'clock at night. Starting August 22nd is the next round of those. And I also have been doing a series of healthy seasonal cooking classes throughout Greene County. And I am going to be upcoming at both the Kasaki Library and the Athens Library. So for more information on those classes, since they're at the libraries, I would tell listeners to contact those libraries and ask for more information and to sign up.
Well, Becky, this has been extremely informative. We really thank you for joining us at Digging In with Master Gardeners. And we wish you continued success in educating all the residents of Columbia and Greene counties about food safety and food preservation, in addition to all the parenting information you provide. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with questions at ccecolumbiagreen.org, visit us in Hudson or in Acre, or ask us questions on the Master Gardeners of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook group. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities. Someone warm them from below till the rains come.